Today on Against the Grain, from charter schools to enterprises like Teach for America, profiteering off of public education has surged, supported by both Democrats and Republicans. But Noliwe Rooks argues that plundering taxpayer-funded education has a long history, going back to the era after Reconstruction. I'm Sasha Lilly. Rooks joins me to discuss that history and whether we're now seeing the slow unraveling of public education in the U.S. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Education in America is separate and unequal, and according to my guest, it's that way by design and for profit. American education is marked by two tiers, with poor kids and kids of color tracked for vocational training at best. Noliwe Rooks argues that while the children may be poor, there are vast amounts of money to be made off of their education, from charter schools to virtual schools and to the private outsourcing of public school administration. Rooks is Director of American Studies at Cornell University and the author of Cutting School, Privatization, Segregation, and the End of Public Education. Her other books include Hair-Raising and White Money, Black Power. Noliwe, what's the state of education in America for children, depending on their racial or class background?
Well, I think one of the things writing this book that I really discovered is despite the fact that there have seriously been changes since the 19th century, clearly, you know, when tax-supported public education came into being, there's this concept of changing same that Amiri Baraka, the poet, came up with that I keep, it's constantly running through my head when I think about, you know, how, what is the state today of education. It's for students who are living in urban areas and in rural areas, our schools in the United States are hugely segregated by race and economics, which was the case in earlier periods. In fact, there have been few periods when that's not the case. Very often, students who are not from wealthy communities, from elite backgrounds, are experimented upon educationally. What that means is their educational forms and delivery methods and the purpose of education is said to be very, very different than the kinds of educational practices and forms that we make available to wealthy students. So vocational schools or privatized instruments like charter management organizations or virtual schools, where students as young as five are spending most of their school time in front of computers with minimal kind of impact and interaction with teachers. These are actual forms of education that you just don't find in wealthy communities.
And what are the consequences then for the children who experience education in wealthy communities versus those who don't?
Well, so here's the thing. What we know from 30, 40 years of research, if not more, is that the one thing that we can count on to work that benefits wealthy kids and economically vulnerable children and across race, ethnicity, sexuality, the thing that works is integration. When you put people who are different from each other in educational settings, all boats rise. That's not to say that's the only thing that could work, that would ever work, that there are not other methods and ways to educate America's children systemically. But we know that one is successful, and that is the one that we seem to be running away from. That's the one solution that we as a nation, if it's policies, if it's housing patterns, if it's bias or inclination, we just simply do not want to integrate our school system. So what that means is wealthy children tend to go to school with wealthy children, poor children tend to go to school with poor children, and educational outcomes differ based on those factors.
Well, how is this separation of children profitable?
Well, Well, one of the things that I thought I was going to do when I first wrote this book, I thought that I was going to talk about the 21st century. I was looking at so much going on around 2010, between 2008 and about 2010. And I was like, you know, these things are happening here. Like, we're having charter schools expanding everywhere. We're having these alternatively certified teaching corps, like Teach for America, or superintendents of schools, administrators who are going to different new kinds of academies to learn their skills, and they're not coming through the traditional kinds of systems. As I did some research, I started to find out the extent to which all of these forms of education actually were profit-producing, were income-producing for companies, which I had not fully realized. And so I kept backing up and trying to find a period where that was not the case. We didn't have philanthropies and businesses and corporations and state-elected officials and federal officials coming together to prescribe certain kinds of education for children based on their class or background or racial background, and I couldn't find it. But what I did come to notice is that it wasn't just in the 21st century that you had what I call segronomics, where the high levels of racial and economic segregation become business opportunities for companies. So today you have things like charter schools, who many charter school operators will talk about 90-90-90 schools, and that's the sweet spot. Those are the schools that you go after. Those are the schools that the philanthropist will give you the most money for, and those are the schools that really raise the profile of charter schools because you can make so much progress in such schools. 90-90-90 schools are 90% of color, so 90% black or Latino, 90% below federally set poverty levels, and 90% performing below grade level. So that's like the high poverty, high of color schools are become the sweet spot, become the opportunity to generate wealth. You do not have the same levels of wealth creation possible in wealthy areas. There are some charter schools that are doing very well in wealthy areas who are educating high income students. Where I used to live in Princeton was one of the first. But they're not the norm. They're not the fastest growing. They're not the ones with the highest profit margin.
And the money is coming from public
tax
monies?
Dollars. So the way that charter schools work is that they are privately managed but publicly financed. So the majority of the money, or a good chunk of the money, I mean, some actually are getting more money from philanthropists. Some chains, you know, 40 to 60% of their income is just, you know, rich people giving them money. But for the most part, what you're talking about are tax dollars. Federal, state, and local tax dollars that go to fund education, you're talking about somewhere between $500 to $600 billion a year. And that has made education and the business of education one of the growth sectors of our economy.
Well, we're going to talk a lot more in the course of the hour about the different forms in the present that are used to generate profit from education, and as you say, much of the money coming from federal or public monies. But let's talk about the history that you referenced, that you were having a hard time finding a time where there wasn't this intersection of philanthropy and business interests mm-hmm. and education. Take us back to the period following Reconstruction. What took place in the United States there in terms of education?
Right. So following the Civil War, there's this period called Reconstruction, and I always feel the need to just point it out because I suppose I should not be surprised how often it is that we sort of miss that. It's not a period that's well taught in high school, let me put it like that. So in the post-Reconstruction period, following when the troops leave the South, so they had to send troops to the South to make sure that the newly freed Black people would not be terrorized and harassed, and to help rebuild the South that had suffered all manner of losses. During this Reconstruction period, there's Black elected officials, we have Black governors, Black senators, education takes off, and you have poor whites as well as black people. Literacy rates are going through the roof in the 13 former slaveholding states. It's just a period of rebuilding, and there's the money to support public education. In the post-Reconstruction period, when the federal troops leave, when we decide we're going to leave the South to their own devices, the first thing that Southern legislatures move to do is to undo both voting and education. So all of the laws that had been passed in the 13-year period that was the Reconstruction period, the post-Civil War, immediately following the Civil War, they got rid of your ability to vote, and they got rid of the opportunity for black people to be educated using tax funds, using public funds. So state legislatures immediately started to, across those 13 states, make it illegal to spend what they call white tax dollars to educate black children. You had to be able to track whose tax dollars were educating who. And black people, most of whom were still agricultural workers, most of whom are working in a sharecropper society where they're working on spec almost. They get paid at the end of the planting season, the harvest season. They were expected to come up with the money to educate their children, but also pay for the education of white children. They were forbidden to go to school with white children. And increasingly, you have philanthropists who came along and said, you know, we also need to be mindful of the fact that the South had been the economic engine for the entire country before the Civil War. The reason the United States was doing well globally in terms of economic growth and expansion really was that all this unpaid free labor, slaves in the South. So the philanthropists and business people said, but what is supposed to happen now? How do we protect the economic interests of the United States? If we have to start paying laborers, the entire country will be impacted. And so what they came up with the help of elected officials in the South was to figure out how to train black people, use education to train black people in particular about vocationally, how to teach them to be good at certain kinds of service professions, certain kinds of work, menial work, hard labor, making bricks, or service was like becoming a teacher. You know, that was fine. If you could teach them to do very specific tasks, then you could educate black people. What they would not do is educate black people in the South following the Civil War in the same ways that they did white people or wealthy people. So whites in the South were overwhelmingly targeted for farming, to teach them how to, the science of farming, to teach them really how to get into the dirt and use modern principles in order to excel. Whereas black people got a very, very different form that was said to teach them the value of hard work and to teach them their place in the South. So that's the beginning of taxpayer-supported education in the South. It features what becomes a consistent theme up through today, where there are periods where we go between plundering, taking, stealing money that is for the education of black children, and then hoarding it and only using it for the education of the wealthy and white kids.
And this agenda also came with a philosophical orientation. Tell us about the notion of so-called self-help as it was projected onto black people.
At that time, yeah. So along with this vocational work, while a lot of these philanthropists and educators and state officials were talking to each other about the need for labor, wanting to make sure that as the West and in the North, you had immigrants, who some of whom were starting to unionize and driving the cost of labor up, they wanted to be able to use black people as strike breakers. They wanted to bring you in, black people in, as a lower cost alternative. At the same time, the way that they talked to black communities about doing this was, you know, we want you to be able to pull yourselves up by your bootstraps, to not be expecting people to do things for you. There's dignity, you know, in doing things for yourself. These are arguments that they're making to black people in the South following the Reconstruction period about the use of taxpayer dollars. No one's telling other recipients of tax money that you need to be worthy of it. So the not scheme, but the thing they came up with that spread across the rural South, former 13 former slaveholding states of the rural South, was these Rosenwald schools are the first iteration. And so Julius Rosenwald was the son of Jewish immigrants who rose up from abject poverty to become the president of Sears and Roebuck. And he wanted to give back. He wanted to do public charity, works of charity in the South. And so he came up with this, well, I'll build schools, but we want them to teach self-help, and we're not going to get white people in the South to sort of start giving things to black people. So he had matching grants, which sounds good on their face. It sounds like, so, you know, when black communities, these dirt poor black communities come up with money, then the foundation will match it, and these communities get a school. That's not exactly how it worked. In order to even qualify for the building program, black communities had to come up with $500.
Enormous amount of money at that time.
In today's dollars, you'd be talking about tens of thousands of dollars. And they would pass the hat. They would sell livestock. They would, all of the money that they had collected for their entire lives, inclusive for some of the time when they'd been enslaved, went into it. And then after you managed to collect that first $500, then you had to find a piece of land to build the school on. And you had to get that land deeded often to state county officials, to county officials. So you had to find somebody with land, some black person with land, and then they had to give it to you so that you could give it to the state. Because the state was not willing to have schools for black children built on public lands, lands that are supported by taxpayer dollars. Then after you deed your land over, then you had to come up with all of the materials that you needed to build the schools. You to identify the lumber and the glass and where are the desks coming from, and you know, you had to identify all of that and have it on hand. So you couldn't just say, I figured out where it's coming from, but I don't know where it is right now. You had to prove that you had it. And then you had to come up with the labor to build it, to use the products to build on the land that you had already found, the materials to build the actual school. And once you had the school built, then the Rosenwald Foundation would give you your other $500. In total, black people ended up spending far more than the foundation, black communities, through their tax dollars, because, again, once you had a school, then the black communities were double taxed. They were taxed another time on top of the taxes for white children. Once you had built this school, then you had to tax yourselves in order to pay for it, because they would not use, you know, they were not going to use white tax dollars to educate black children. So the cost of educating black people, the public cost, really did, it was huge, and it came from black communities and not from foundations or the state. So that's one example of how this consistent, this pendulum swing where you steal, you plunder it, you take it, you grab it. Money that is supposed to be that the federal government is sending South in order to educate all children in the South, you take that, you forbid black people to have access to that, and then you come up with this whole scheme where you say, but look, you get to know the glory of figuring out how to find money and educate yourself.
Naliwe Rooks is my guest. We're talking about her book, Cutting School, Privatization, Segregation, and the End of Public Education. My name is Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain. So taking this history up then to the civil rights era, reforms took place that were heralded for ending segregation in education, but you argue that there never was a commitment to full integration. Tell us about that period and why you argue that.
Yeah, I think what most learn in high school, you know, about Brown v. Board of Education. So in 1954, the Supreme Court overturned previous laws guarding education and made it illegal to require that the races be educated separately. And so you had to integrate. You had to desegregate schools. There were a lot of people in the South. I mean, while we often celebrate that sort of nationally as this sort of moment of justice, there were a lot of white people in the South who really were beyond taken aback by the idea that the Supreme Court would basically, in their telling, force them to have to spend money on black people getting educated, but also force them to send their children to schools with black people. Like, this is a region of the country that literally had enshrined white supremacy in the Jim Crow era with every manner of law that they could, following the Reconstruction period, to make clear this is a region that believes in white supremacy. White people get to vote. White people get to go to school. White people get to walk on the sidewalk, and if you're black, you should step off and walk in the street. The idea that these people somewhere in Washington, where, you know, folks are all across the South were sort of like, but they don't know us, they don't know our ways. They were irate. It was not a great moment for them, and they came up with this idea of massive resistance. And this massive resistance actually was begun by the United States Senate. It was not begun by, you know, hood-wearing Klans members, whose names we don't know, sitting senators and Congress people, you know, who represented the South, said, you know, we stand with our constituents there in the South. They should not be forced to spend time and interact with black people, and these states should not be forced to spend money educating black students. So, in that period, which is the entire delegation of the South, over 100 Congress people, Senate and the Senate and the Congress, you know, sign on to this thing. Not to mention untold, you know, numbers of governors across the South, and say, that's right, where every legal means that we can come up with, we are going to resist this. And the first thing they did was go about the business of legislating new laws that made it possible for them to do things like use taxpayer money once again to found segregation academies, the money that's coming to educate all children in the South. They said, you know, we're going to allow private schools to open, and the private schools will be paid for with tax dollars, you know, with property tax dollars. So, which, you know, most of the people who own property were white people. And you can get a check. We will allow you to come to us at the Board of Education or the courthouse, whatever it is, and we will give you a check that you can use to pay for tuition at one of these new all-white private schools. So they open private schools because Brown v. Board of Education only applied to public schools. So one of the ways of avoiding having to comply with it was they literally went to the public schools that had been educating black students or white students and took everything that was in it. They would just clean them out of desks and chalkboards and everything else, and took them to these so-called private schools that had been founded with donations from the North, by and large, but kept open by tax dollars that were supposed to be going to fund public schools. And then, after they figured out how to educate white students, they closed the public school system so that black children could not be educated, right? So they took the money, started segregation academies that are white-only in the face of this decree saying that separate but equal is no longer the law of the land and we have to integrate. And then in some states, some cities in different states, they just closed the entire school system. So black children, you had for years, one in Virginia, it was almost 5 years, Prince Edward's County, closed their system for 5 years. And the impact on the black community during that period, as you can imagine, was horrendous. It was horrendous. People had to go to black colleges or move to another state, or some people just joined the military or just dropped out, all because whites in the South were just simply still unwilling to pay for and educate black children.
What about the North? Often the focus on segregation and education is on the South, but take us through the history of segregated education in the North and how decisions like Brown versus Board of Education did or did not change education in the North.
Yeah, so the thing that actually broke the back of so-called massive resistance in the South was President Johnson tied funding, like what he basically said in 1964 in the Civil Rights Act, and by the way, if you maintain segregation on the books, like if you make integration illegal, you Southern states, you will get zero funding. You will get zero money from the federal government. And it didn't take long, a few years, you know, 3-4 years. People continued to try to fight it until the very late 60s, very early 70s. But then at some point it became clear. We need this money, and we're going to have to integrate. The North had never really been impacted in the same way by Brown v. Board, because Brown v. Board spoke specifically about state-sanctioned segregation. Specifically, if you had laws on your books that made it illegal for blacks and whites to go to school together, that's who Brown v. Board was talking about, not private schools and not northern schools, where it wasn't mandated that, you know, we will not educate children of different races together. It just so happened that housing patterns in the North basically did that work for them. They didn't have to make the schools integrated or segregated. They didn't have to put those on the books, because neighborhoods in the North, unlike the South, were hugely segregated by race. So the thing then became, if we're going to integrate schools, as they sort of looked around and they're like, well, we're not court ordered, but maybe we should do some things too. Things are not necessarily fully integrated here. Busing became the solution. If whites have moved out to the suburbs, if you have to figure out, and that's where the wealthy schools are, you have to figure out how to then get poor children and children of color out to the suburbs. This became the line in the sand for the North. Some people remember, but not people do not always remember the frenzy of violence that accompanied ideas of forcing black and white children to have to be bused to be integrated. There were bombings in outside of Michigan. The Ku Klux Klan was convicted for bombing buses once where there were just no people were on it. They just bombed the buses that were empty so that they could not pick up black children and bring them to Michigan schools. And in other places, they actually bombed buses where children were sitting on the buses in order to stop them. White supremacists and Klan members were taking down buses, throwing dynamite, blowing them up. In front of schools, there would just be a frenzy of anger and activity, like schools like Boston, where, you know, the idea that you would put black children in some of these white schools or make white students get on buses to go integrate black schools. And even at the federal level, our former vice president, Joe Biden, sponsored a bill on behalf of his constituents in Delaware that said that it was illegal to use federal dollars to buy gasoline if the gasoline was going to go into buses for the purpose of integration. So he didn't say, you know, I don't believe in integration, but, you know, if you're going to have to find your own money, you cannot spend any money, districts, school districts, on gas for buses if it's going to go for integration. So it wasn't exactly the same, but again, that concept of changing same, like it sort of looked very similar. It looked like people in the north were no more, especially in the suburbs, were no more interested in racial integration than were our southern countrymen.
And then Nixon brings to an end federal funds for busing. And
right.
At that point, what happens to a commitment to the integration of public schools?
Well, right. So Nixon, what he did was a whole new separate but equal move. So he kind of went, okay, I'm gonna forget just messing around with buses. Now, no money for any kind of integration efforts, no federal money at all. But he did say, but I'll give urban school districts more money. Like if you'll just like shut up and let it go, basically, I'll give you more money. But we're done funding integration. This is in the midst of a huge kind of change. You have George Wallace, who in 1972 is running for president. Nixon's running against him, who was a racist, an avowed racist. He's a segregationist. He's known for standing in the courthouse door at the University of Alabama and saying segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever, just pledging, you know, his entire life to upholding segregation. So as these racial issues were really tearing the North apart, these issues around segregation and integrating schools, it became clear to Nixon and some of his advisors, you know, I have talked about and have written about, how they were like, if you're going to win, you better put yourself on the side of the white parents who hate busing. You better figure out how to out-racist the avowed racist George Wallace. And you need to do more and go farther to make clear that you will not force whites to have to integrate, which he did quite successfully. And after an initial kind of frenzy of funding schools in urban areas, so-called, you know, giving them a little bit more, he cut off those funds too. And so what you were left with were urban areas that were bereft of funding, where there was just no money to for public education.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Today I'm speaking with Noliwe Rooks. She's the author of Cutting School, Privatization, Segregation, and the End of Public Education. That's published by the New Press, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. She's Director of American Studies at Cornell University. So we've been talking a lot about the history of separate education in the United States, but bringing things closer to the present, you make the argument that education in America has always been separate, and that has been really the intent. And at the same time, there has been a consistent plundering of public education for profit.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to ask you more about that. There's a recognition through various sectors of society that something is wrong with schools, or something is wrong with education, or perhaps the outcomes of different children should be of concern. But the solutions that have been on offer come with all sorts of assumptions about what education should be. Tell us about the way that, if it's being addressed, that inequality is being addressed in education today.
I guess the easiest thing is to back up to Reagan, quite frankly, who sort of began a march away from thinking about education in relationship to equality and democracy into a narrative that wanted to talk much more about the outcomes in relation to business. In a way, it's going back to the beginning again when public education was talked about as, you know, what about labor? How will business benefit? So under Reagan, you get a commission called the Nation at Risk. It was a high-level commission that spent 2 years studying public schools. It was comprised of business owners, corporate execs, and elected officials. And at the end of the 2 years, you know, they said, all of this focus that we've been having, I'm totally paraphrasing, but if you distill what they said, all of this focus that we have had on equality, integration, social engineering, and trying to make society in some image that we have, as opposed to accepting what it is, the impact on the schools has been horrendous. We are now, falling fast from favor. Our test scores are down. Our graduates are down. People are just not as smart. And one of the often quoted lines is something along the lines of, if a foreign power had forced this upon us, we would consider it an act of war. So we need to move away from thinking about education and equality and the American dream and all of that, and really start talking more about how can we use the public education system to more clearly and closely serve the interests of business. So over the course of the next 5 years or so, there's almost 300 of these different commissions that all start saying the same thing, right? Businesses, what do businesses need? What do businesses need in workers? The curriculum needs to follow that. We're just not getting this done. Businesses are not happy. So between Reagan and Obama, one of the things I point out is that President Obama, you really have this arc where the concerns of business, the ways the business want American education to function, start to take over. And by the Clinton years, you have these privatized forms of education that he agrees to allow lobbyists to start to go after lawmakers to make their case. So people like charter school chains, he says, okay, charter schools, privatized companies that want to use public dollars, let them have it. And by the time that you get to, the Bushes also, were big into these corporate forms of education, and with No Child Left Behind, that introduced a whole business around testing, because the whole thing about No Child Left Behind really was that, we need to understand where our most vulnerable, struggling students are, how far behind they are before we can make interventions, which sounds good on its face, but what it actually did was turn testing children into a multi-billion dollar industry within a couple of years. And then President Obama turned a lot of this march into federal policy, into federal law. So by the time in 2009, where he institutes his first big policy around education, it's a school improvement fund, where he says, I'm really going to make sure that children have what they need in terms of infrastructure in schools. It's hard to miss the fact that all of the money that's being put into education in order to aid educational practices, really it has nothing to do with what we know works best in terms of raising achievement levels. And we moved very far away from the 70s onward, away from, again, what we knew worked. We knew that integration was raising test scores, was having all boats rise. It wasn't perfect, but it did the thing we needed to have done. We moved far from that into coming up with completely separate educational products based on the race and class of people. So, charter schools with these 90-90-90 schools are able to profit from segregation. Organizations like Teach for America, which starts in 1989, by 2016 was worth almost $400 million and had pledged themselves to training teachers to go into rural and urban schools, and they would raise the achievement gaps, and that did not happen. However, the company benefited greatly, and you even had Wall Street discovering education, so you had some charter management organizations and private company saying to struggling school districts, you know, we'll come in there and we will manage your entire school district, making millions and millions of dollars for the owners of the companies, but leaving the children uneducated. And so as we move from the 70s into today, what we've seen is a chipping away at the idea of education as this sort of great equalizer, as a way that if the children work hard, we can educate them as all American citizens, having access to the same kinds of education. And it now makes sense to far too many of us that depending on the race and class of the child in the classroom, they need special kinds of education. They need charter schools. They need technology. They need things that, quite frankly, middle class and wealthy parents would never allow happen to their kids. That's federal policy now.
What do you think is driving this then, or is it the confluence of two things? Is it the sense that through charter schools and these other things that are being pushed, that poor and students of color are being given a vocational education, or is it not even a pretense at that, and this is just a profit-driven model, and that ultimately is the final aim?
Well, I mean, I think what has actually happened is public schools, it started in the 70s with Nixon, but up through time, public schools have really been defunded at an aggressive pace. At the state level, states have, especially in the last 20 years or so, really started to allocate money, take it out of public education, use it for other things. And what that leaves is you still have all these kids that need to be educated, and you don't have the money to do it. You can't pay for it. And so in poor areas, it's a godsend when you have people come in and say, you know, we believe that we can solve all your problems. We can educate the children, and we can have them test at levels that will rival what's happening in more wealthy schools. And so over that period of time from the 70s to today, one of the things that we've seen is the outcomes, the thing for poor children, poor communities, that matters most are the test scores. As against, my son went to private school for some years, and one of the things I was surprised by is that there is almost no focus on testing in private schools. In the schools that are educating the children of the billionaires who are driving ed reform for poor children, the Betsy DeVoses of the world, the Mark Zuckerberg and his wife, the things that they are paying for in terms of what they value for education when it comes to poor kids in communities are not things that are in evidence in the schools that educate their kids. They would never, you would never, not even at the billionaire level, you would never in the upper middle class level have people say, what I think is best for my child is to sit in front of a computer for 8 hours a day with very little interaction from any kind of teacher. You would never have them say, what I most want for my child as a wealthy person paying my tax dollars to fund schools is a teaching corps who've had 5 weeks of training. I want them to come in and are only going to stay for 2 years. That's who I want educating my kid. I want my child to be educated in a rote fashion where we're doing a lot of memorization and worksheets and calling out answers, but they're not getting creativity, they're not getting art, they're not getting music. You just don't have it. But that has become, those have become ubiquitous in poor communities, and that we don't even notice anymore how far away it is from the kinds of educations most of us who are in the middle class want for our kids, I think really says something about us at this point, as much as these people who have found a way to benefit from providing these educations.
Nelewe Rooks, where is this all going? I mean, the ominous words of your subtitle is the end of public education. Do you see things heading in that direction?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, in rural areas, again, and in urban areas, struggling urban areas, we are literally watching a dismantling of traditional public education. In places like New Orleans, I'm sure most of us know, it's like 90% charter school. Public education, as most of us think about it, with school boards and, you know, parental interaction and some kind of democracy, just doesn't exist there. In D.C., we're up to about, I think it's right around 50% of the schools are charter schools as opposed to traditional public schools. In Philadelphia, between school closures and the rise of, in Philadelphia, of virtual education, you have the people there really who really want to have virtual education educate most of the children. We are literally, in ways that I think people who live in the suburbs or in wealthier places just really don't understand. Like, they will say, so you're being a little hysterical and hyperbolic. You know, you're just trying to make a point there by talking about the end of public education. And I'm sort of like, no, I'm just noticing what is happening in communities and amongst people middle-class folks just don't have reasons to interact with. So for certain segments of the country, depending on where you live, traditional public education, as the rest of us know it, is in fact being actively dismantled.
You were describing, in many ways, the continuity between the Clinton era, George W. Bush, Obama, in terms of education policy and the continuation of both the separation of children by race and class and the plunder of public education by private businesses and private entities. Under Trump, do you think we will just simply see more of the same, or do you think all of these forces are going to be intensified in this period?
Well, I mean, one of the things about Betsy DeVos, it's funny, people often say, you know, Betsy DeVos, who's so extreme and so horrible, and she is. She is on the fringe of thinking, traditional thinking or mainstream thinking about education. However, it's just on the fringe. She's not totally unrecognizable. So she does not believe in government schools, as she calls them. What she calls public schools are government schools. And she says, you know, she wants the money. What she believes in is the money that is given to government schools, and she wants that to be given to parents. And she calls it school choice, and so that parents can then make the determinations with that taxpayer money about where they want their kids educated. But the thing that I often want to point out is that would actually be the position, I think, of a majority of Democratic governors, you know, from California to, well, we have so few Democratic governors at this point, but we have precious few who do not believe that we need to promote school choice, that we need to promote...
School choice being a euphemism for charter schools.
For charter schools and religious schools. Some are into vouchers. You know, the few, but some believe, as Betsy DeVos believes, that you literally, like going back to the segregation academies that I talked about in the 1950s, it is the literal same thing, or it's a first cousin, it's a kissing cousin, where you give parents the funds and they take that money to private schools, where they can choose if they want religious schools, they can choose all-white schools, private schools that are not regulated in the same ways as our public schools. What she has advocated in Michigan in particular, but all over the country, she's worked with groups all over the country and funded nonprofits all over the country that advocate making it possible for parents to take this money, do what they want to with it. The thing is, everywhere that this happens, that you actually see moves made in that direction, who it benefits are middle and upper middle class white families who take that money, run away from any kind of integrated schools, and put their children into private schools. So that ends up further exacerbating segregation. It exacerbates it. It makes it more likely that we will continue to be these two nations, one white and one black.
Well, and what do we know about the degree to which there are white kids in public classrooms over the last several decades?
Oh, well, so the thing about public education in general is since 2014, it has become, like, public schools across the country, taken as a whole, are predominantly 51% of the students fall below federal poverty levels. And right at 50, I think it's 51% of the students are non-white. So since 2014, because of changing demographics and an increase in white people putting their children in private schools, the public school system is majority, a bare majority, it's a simple majority, but have become majority poor and of color. So all of these moves that are being made to shift around public education dollars really have an outside impact on poor children of color, which very often, given the way that residential segregation works, is if you're living in a community like I do, like in Ithaca or where I was previously at Princeton Public Schools, if you're looking around, you're kind of like, you know, public schools seem like they're doing okay. You know, that's fine. They're still very integrated. It's a place for middle-class kids to still get a leg up. And I think one of the things that we don't notice or don't know or don't understand is across the country, what is true for wealthy whites or Asians or high-performing students, wealthy upper-middle-class students, is just simply not true for the rest of the country, and that is the majority of students who are being educated with these funds.
I've been speaking with Noliwe Rooks about her book, Cutting School, Privatization, Segregation, and the End of Public Education. You can find a link to that book on our website, againstthegrain.org. Her other books include White Money, Black Power, and Hair Raising, and she's Director of American Studies at Cornell University. Noliwe, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
And you've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.